Side 6. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 200.
All right. You've never ridden a horse before, have you?
We do not keep horses. We seldom leave our valley, so we have little need of them.
They're fairly nice animals. Be a little careful of the one Sparhawk rides, though. He bites. Now, this horse is a pack animal. He's fairly old and sensible, so he won't waste energy jumping around and being silly. Don't worry too much about the reins. He's used to following along after the others, so you don't have to steer him. If you want him to go faster, nudge him in the ribs with your heels. If you want him to slow down, pull back on the reins a little bit. If you want him to stop, pull back a little harder. That pack saddle's not going to be very comfortable, so let us know if you start getting stiff and sore. We'll stop and get off and walk for a while. You'll get used to it after a few days, if we've got that far to travel.
She held out her hands, crossed at the wrist. Wilt thou bind me now, Sir Knight?
What for?
I am thy prisoner.
Don't be silly. You won't be able to hold on if your hands are tied.
He set his jaw, reached out, and took her by the waist. Then he lifted her easily up onto the patient pack horse. Then he held out his hands and looked at them.
So far, so good, he said. At least my fingernails haven't fallen off. I'll be right beside you, so if you feel yourself starting to slip, let me know.
We always underestimate him,
Vanyan murmured to Sparhawk.
There's a lot more to him than meets the eye, isn't there?
Colton? Oh, yes, my lord. Colton can be very complicated sometimes.
They rode away from their fortified cave and followed the gorge the river had cut down through the rock. Sparhawk and Vanyan led the way, with Colton and their hostage riding close behind them. Sophrenia, her face coldly set, rode at the rear with Barrett, keeping as much distance as possible between herself and Zanisha.
"Is it very far?" Colton asked the pale woman at his side. "I mean, how many days will it take us to get there?"
"The distance is indeterminate, Sir Colton," Zanisha replied, "and the time as well. The Delphae are outcast and despised. We would be unwise to make the location of the Valley of Delphaeus widely known."
"We're used to traveling, lady," Colton told her, "and we always pay attention to landmarks. If you take us to Delphaeus, we'll be able to find it again. All we'd have to do is find that cave and start from there."
"That is the flaw in thy plan, Sir Knight," she said gently. "Thou couldst consume a lifetime in the search for that cave. It is our wont to conceal the approaches to Delphaeus rather than Delphaeus itself."
"It's a little hard to conceal a whole mountain range, isn't it?"
"We noted that selfsame thing ourselves, Sir Colton," she replied without so much as a smile. "So we conceal the sky instead. Without the sun to guide thee, thou art truly lost."
"Could you do that, Sparhawk?" Colton raised his voice slightly. "Could you make the whole sky overcast like that?"
"Could we?"
Sparhawk asked Vanyan.
"I couldn't. Maybe Sophrenia could, but under the circumstances it might not be a good idea to ask her. I know enough to know that it's against the rules, though. We are not supposed to play around with the weather."
"We do not, in truth, cloud the sky, Lord Vanyan," Zanisha assured him. "We cloud thine eyes instead. We can, and we choose, make others see what we wish them to see."
"Please, Anaray," Ulaf said with a pained look. "Don't go into too much detail. You'll bring on one of those tedious debates about illusion and reality, and I really hate those."
They rode on, with the now unobscured sun clearly indicating their line of travel. They were moving somewhat northeasterly. Colton watched their prisoner, or captor, closely. and he called halt somewhat more frequently than he might normally have done. When they stopped, he helped the strange, pale woman down from her horse and walked beside her as they continued on foot, leading their horses.
"Thou art overly solicitous of my comfort, Sir Carlton,"
she gently chided him.
"Oh, it's not for you, lady," he lied. "The going's a bit steep here, and we don't want to exhaust the horses."
"There's definitely more to Carlton than I'd realized,"
Vanyan muttered to Sparhawk.
"You can spend a whole lifetime watching somebody, my friend, and you still won't learn everything there is to know about him."
"What an astonishingly acute perception,"
Vanyan said dryly.
"Be nice," Sparhawk murmured.
Sparhawk was troubled. While Zanisha was certainly not as skilled as Afriel, it was clear that she was tampering with time and distance in the same way the child goddess did. If she had maintained the illusion of an overcast sky, he might not have noticed, but the position of the sun clearly indicated that there were gaps in his perception of time. The sun does not normally jump as it moves across the sky. The troubling fact was not that Zanisha did it badly, but the fact that she did it at all. Sparhawk began to revise a long-held opinion. This tampering was obviously not a purely divine capability. Itanya's rather sketchy discourse on the Delphi had contained at least some elements of truth. There was indeed such a thing as Delphaic magic, and so far as Sparhawk could tell, it went further, and into areas where Styrix were unable or unwilling to venture. He kept his eyes open, but did not mention his observations to his friends. And then, on a perfect autumn evening, when the birds clucked and murmured sleepily in the trees, and a luminous twilight turned the mountains purple around them, they rode up a narrow, rocky trail that wound around massive boulders toward a V-shaped notch high above. Zanisha had been most insistent that they not stop for the night, and she and Carlton had pressed on ahead. Her normally placid face seemed somehow alight with anticipation. When she and her protector reached the top of the trail, they stopped and sat their horses, starkly outlined against the last rosy vestiges of the sunset.
"Dear God!" Carlton exclaimed. "Sparhawk, come up and look at this!"
Sparhawk and Vanyan rode on up to join them. There was a valley below, a steep, basin-like mountain valley with dark trees shrouding the slopes. There were houses down there, close-packed houses with candle-lighted windows and with columns of pale blue smoke rising straight up into the evening air from innumerable chimneys. The fact that there was a fair-sized town this deep in the inaccessible mountains was surprising enough. But Sparhawk and the others were not looking at the town. In the very center of the valley, there was a small lake. There was, of course, nothing unusual about that. Lakes abound in mountains in all parts of the world. The spring runoff from melting snow inevitably seeks valleys and basins, any place that is lower than the surrounding terrain and from which there is no exit channel. It was not the fact that the lake was there that was so surprising. The thing that startled them and raised those vestigial hackles of superstitious awe along the backs of their necks was the fact that the lake glowed in the lowering twilight. The light was not the sickly, greenish glow of the phosphorescence that is sometimes exuded by rotting vegetable matter, but was instead a clear, steady white. Like a lost moon, the lake glowed, responding to the light of her new-risen sister, standing above the eastern horizon.
"Behold Delphaeus,"
Zanisha said simply, and when they looked at her, they saw that she, too, was all aglow with a pure white light that seemed to come from within her, and that shone through her garment and through her skin itself, as if that pale, unwavering light were coming from her very soul.
Chapter 14. Sparhawk's senses were preternaturally acute for some reason, although his mind seemed detached and emotionless. He observed, he heard, he catalogued, but he felt nothing. The peculiar state was not an unfamiliar one, but the circumstances under which this profound calm had come over him were unusual. Very unusual. There were no armed men facing him, and yet his mind and body were preparing for battle. Farron tensed, bunching his muscles, and the sound of his steel-shod hooves altered very slightly, becoming somehow more crisp, more deliberate. Sparhawk touched the big roan's neck with one hand. "Relax," he murmured. "I'll let you know when the time comes." Farron shuddered, absently flicking his master's reassurance off like a bothersome insect and continuing his cautious pace. Vanyan looked at his friend questioningly.
"Farron's being a little sensitive, my lord." "Sensitive? That ill-tempered brute?"
"Farron really doesn't deserve that reputation, Vanyan. When you get right down to it, he's a good-natured horse. He tries very hard to please me. We've been together for so long that he knows what I'm feeling most of the time, and he goes out of his way to match his attitude to mine. I'm the one who's the ill-tempered brute, but he gets all the blame. He behaves like a puppy when Afriel's riding on his back."
"Are you feeling belligerent just now?"
"I don't like being led around by the nose, but it's nothing specific. You've overtrained me, Vanyan. Anytime anything unusual comes up, I start getting ready for war. Farron can feel that, so he does the same." Zanisha and Calton were leading them across the meadow that sloped down toward the glowing lake and the strangely alien town nestled on the near shore. The pale Delphaic woman still glowed with that eerie light. The radiance surrounding her seemed to Sparhawk's heightened senses to be almost a kind of aura, a mark more of a special kind of grace rather than a loathsome contamination.
"It's all one building. Did you notice that?" Talon was saying to his brother. "It looks like any other city from a distance, but when you get closer, you start to see that the houses are all connected together."
Khalad grunted.
"It's a stupid idea," he said. "A fire could burn out the whole town."
"The buildings are made of stone. They won't burn."
"But the roofs are thatch, and thatch will burn. It's a bad idea."
Delphaeus had no separate wall as such. The outermost houses, all interconnected, turned their backs to the world, facing inward with their windowless rear walls presented to the outside. Sparhawk and the others followed Zanisha through a deep, dark archway into the city. There was a peculiar fragrance about Delphaeus, a scent of new-mown hay. The streets were narrow and twisting, and they frequently ran through the buildings, passing under heavy arches into vaulted corridors that emerged again on the far side. As Talon had noted, Delphaeus was all one building, and what would have been called streets in another town were simply unroofed hallways here. The citizens did not avoid their party, but they made no particular effort to approach. Like pale ghosts, they drifted through the shadowy maze. "No torches," Barrett noted, looking around.
"No need," Uloth grunted.
"Truly," the young knight agreed. "Notice how it changes the smell of the place? Even Kyrellos always reeks of burning pitch, even in the daytime. It's a little strange to be in a city that doesn't have that greasy smoke clinging to everything."
"I don't think the world at large is ready for self-illuminating people yet, Barrett. It's an idea that probably won't catch on, particularly in view of the drawbacks attached to it."
"Where are we going, lady?" Calton asked the pale, glowing woman at his side. Calton's situation was a peculiar one. He guarded and protected Zanisha. He was solicitous about her comfort and well-being. He would, however, be the one who would kill her at the first sign of hostility from her people.
"We go to the quarters of the Anorai," Zanisha replied. "It is he who must place our proposal before Annika. Annika holds the keys to Belium, and only he can command it."
"You could have saved the rest of us a lot of trouble and made this trip alone, Sparhawk," Talon said lightly.
"Maybe, but it's always nice to have company. Besides, if you hadn't come along, you'd have missed all the fun. Look at how entertaining it was to jump off that cliff and lounge around in midair with about 1,000 feet of absolute emptiness under you.
I've been trying very hard to forget about that, my lord, the boy replied with a pained expression. They dismounted in one of those vaulted corridors near the center of the city, and turned their horses over to several young Delphi. The young men looked to Sparhawk like goatherds who had been pressed into service as stable boys. Then they followed the glowing woman to a dark-stained door, worn with centuries of use. Sparhawk, still in the grip of that emotionless calm, looked carefully at Zanisha. She was not much bigger than Sophronia, and although she was clearly a woman, and quite an attractive one, that fact somehow had no meaning. Zanisha's gender seemed irrelevant. She opened the worn door and led them into a hallway with deeply inset doorways piercing the walls at widely spaced intervals. The hallway was lighted by glass globes hanging on long chains from the vaulted ceiling, globes filled with a glowing liquid, water drawn from the lake, Sparhawk surmised. At the far end of the corridor, Zanisha paused in front of one of the doors, and her eyes grew distant for a moment.
"Sedum bids us to enter,"
she said after a brief pause. She opened the door, and with Calton close behind her, she led them into the chambers beyond.
"The Hall of Sedum, Anorai of the Delphi,"
she told them in that peculiarly echoing voice that seemed to be one of the characteristics of her race. 3 worn stone steps led down into the central chamber, a tidy room with vaulted ceilings supported by low, heavy arches. The slightly inwardly curving walls were covered with white plaster, and the low, heavy furniture was upholstered with snowy lamb's wool. A small fire burned in an arched fireplace at the far end of the room, and more of those glowing globes hung from the ceiling. Sparhawk felt like a crude, barbaric intruder here. Sedan's home reflected a gentle, saintly nature, and the big Pandian was acutely conscious of his chainmail shirt and the heavy broadsword belted at his waist. He felt bulky and out of place, and his companions, wrapped in steel and leather and rough gray cloth, seemed to loom around him like the crude monoliths of an ancient and primitive culture. A very old man entered from the far side of the room. He was frail and bent, and his shuffling steps were aided by a long staff. His hair was wispy and snowy white, in his case the mark of extreme age rather than a racial characteristic. In addition to his unbleached wool robe, he wore a kind of shawl about his thin shoulders. Zanisha went to him immediately, touching his wrinkled old face with a gentle hand. Her eyes were full of concern for him, but she did not speak.
"Well met, Sir Knights,"
the old man greeted them. He spoke in only slightly accented Alenic, and his voice sounded thin and rusty, as if he seldom had occasion to speak at all.
"And welcome to thee as well, dear sister," he added, speaking to Sophronia in nearly flawless, though archaic, Styric.
"I am not your sister, old man," she said, her face cold.
"We are all brothers and sisters, Sophronia of Ilara, High Priestess of Athriel. Our kinship lies in our common humanity."
"That may have been true once, Delphi," she replied in a voice like ice, "but you and your accursed race are no longer human."
He sighed.
"Perhaps not. It's hard to say precisely what we are, or what we will become. Put aside thine enmity, Sophronia of Ilara. Thou wilt come to no harm in this place, and for once our purposes merge into one. Thou wouldst set us apart from the rest of mankind, and that is now also our desire. May we not join our efforts to achieve this end?"
She turned her back on him. Itania, ever the diplomat, stepped in to fill the awkward gap.
"Sedum, I presume?"
he said urbanely. The old man nodded.
"I find Delphaeus puzzling, revered one, I must confess it. We Tamils know virtually nothing about your people, and yet the Delphae have been central to a grossly affected genre in our literature. I've always felt that this so-called Delphaic literature had been spun out of whole cloth by third-rate poets with diseased imaginations. Now I come to Delphaeus,
and find that all manner of things I had believed to be literary conceits have more than a little basis in fact. Itania was smooth. There was no question about that. His assertion that he was even more clever than his brother, the foreign minister, was probably quite true. The NRI smiled faintly.
We did what we could, Itania of Methyrian. I will grant thee that the verse is execrable and the sentimentality appalling, but Zadony did serve the purpose for which it was created. It softened and turned aside certain of the antagonisms the Styrix had planted in your society. The Tamils control the Aetons, and we did not wish a confrontation with our towering neighbors. I cringe to confess it to thee, but I myself played no small part in the composition of Zadony.
Itania blinked.
Sedon, are we talking about the same poem? The Zadony I studied as a schoolboy was written about 700 years ago.
Has it been so long? Where do the years go? I did enjoy my stay in fire-domed Methyrian. The university was stimulating.
Itania was too well trained to show his astonishment.
Your features are Tamil, Sedon, but didn't your coloration seem odd?
Ye Tamils are far too civilized to make an issue of deformity. My racial characteristics were simply taken to mean that I was an albino. The condition is not unheard of. I had a colleague, a Styric, who had a club foot. Rather surprisingly, we got on well together. I note from thy speech that contemporary Tamil hath changed from what it was when I was last among thy people. That would make it difficult for me to return to Methyrian. Please accept my apologies for Zadony. It is truly abominable. But, as I say, it served its purpose.
I should have known, Sophronia cut in. The whole body of Delphic literature was created with the sole purpose of fostering a climate of anti-Styric bigotry.
And what was the purpose of the eons of outright falsehood with which ye Styrix deceived the Tamils?
Sedon demanded.
Was the design not precisely the same? Did ye not seek to instill the idea in the Tamil perception that the Delphi are subhuman?
Sophronia ignored the question.
Does your hatred of us run so deep that you would contaminate the understanding of an entire race?
And how deeply doth thy hatred run, Sophronia of Ilara? Art thou not even now attempting to poison the minds of these simple Alenes against us?
The NRI sank into a cushioned chair, passing one weary hand across his face.
Our mutual hatreds have gone, methinks, too far to be healed. Better far that we live apart. And that doth bring us to the issue which hath brought us together. It is our wish to be apart from all others.
Because you're so much better than the rest of us?
Sophronia's tone was thick with contempt.
Not better, priestess. Only different. We will leave that puffed-up sense of superiority to thy race.
If you two want to renew a few eons-old hatreds, I think the rest of us would prefer not to sit through it,
Vanyan said coolly.
You both seem quite able to manage without our help.
You don't know what they've done, Vanyan,
Sophronia said, with a mute appeal in her eyes.
Frankly, dear, I'm not really interested in what happened several thousand years ago. If you want to chew old soup, please do it on your own time.
Vanyan looked at the ancient Delphi.
I believe you had some kind of an exchange in mind, Sedon. We'd love to sit around and watch you and Sophronia slice each other into thin strips, but we're a little pressed for time. Affairs of state, you understand.
Even Sparhawk choked a bit on that.
Thou art very blunt, Lord Vanyan,
Sedon said in a coldly reproving tone.
I'm a soldier, revered NRI. A conversation made up of spiteful little insults bores me. If you and Sophronia really want to fight, use axes.
Have you had many occasions to deal with Alines, revered Anorai? Itanya asked in an unruffled manner.
Almost none.
You might consider offering up a few prayers of thanksgiving for that. The Alines have this distressing tendency to get right to the point. It's dreadfully uncivilized, of course, but it does save time. I believe you wanted to address your proposal to Annika. That's him right there. I should probably warn you that Lord Vanyan is the absolute soul of finesse when compared to Sparhawk. But Sparhawk is Annika, so sooner or later you're going to have to deal with him.
Since we've all decided to be unpleasant this evening, I don't think we'll get very far, Sparhawk said. Why don't you tell me what you want, Seaton, and what you're prepared to offer in return? I'll think it over tonight, and then we can talk about it tomorrow, after we've had time to get a firmer grip on our civility.
A wise course, perhaps, Annika, the old man agreed. There is turmoil afoot in Tomoli.
Yes, we've noticed that.
The turmoil is not directed at the Empire, Annika, but at thee. Thou were lured here because thou hast the keys to Belium. Thine enemies covet the jewel.
We know that, too. I don't really need a preamble, Seaton. What's the point of this?
We will aid thee in thy struggle, and I do assure thee that without our aid thou canst not prevail.
You'll have to convince me of that. But we can talk about it some other time. What do you want in return?
We would have thee take up Belium and seal us in this valley.
That's all?
That is all we ask. Put us beyond the reach of all others, and put all others beyond our reach. All will be served by this, Aline and Tommel, Styric and Delphae. Use the infinite power of Belium to set us apart from the rest of mankind, so that we may continue our journey undisturbed.
Journey?
A figure of speech, Annika. Our journey is measured in generations, not in leagues.
An even exchange, then? You'll help us to deal with our enemies if I close off this valley so that no one can ever get in? Or out?
An even exchange, Annika.
All right. I'll think about it.
She won't talk to me about it, Sparhawk, Vanyan sighed, or about anything else for that matter.
The silvery-haired preceptor and his friend were speaking privately in a small room just off the corridor that led to the cluster of tiny cell-like rooms where they had spent the night.
You were just a bit blunt last night, Sparhawk told him.
Irrational behavior irritates me. I wish Afriel were here. She could straighten Sophronia out in fairly short order.
Sparhawk slid lower in his chair.
I'm not so sure, Vanyan. I don't know if I'm supposed to tell you this, but I get the feeling that Afriel wouldn't interfere.
Before she left, she told me that Sophronia has to work this out for herself.
Could Itanya shed any light on this antagonism between the Styrix and the Delphae?
Sparhawk shook his head.
No more than he's already told us. The whole business seems to date back to the time of the war with the Sirgai. That was about 10,000 years ago, so history's a little vague about what really happened. Evidently, the Styrix and the Delphae were allies, and there seems to have been a betrayal of some sort.
I gathered as much. Can Itanya make any guesses about who was betrayed?
No. The Styrix have made themselves useful to the Tommels over the centuries, as they made themselves useful to the Church in Eosia. They've been busy insinuating their version of what happened into the Tommel perception of history. From what Seaton told us last night, I'd say that the Delphae have infiltrated the University of Mytherian and inserted Delphaic literature into the Tommel culture with precisely the same idea. The events of 10,000 years ago
are going to be buried under a thick layer of myth and legend anyway, and with both the Styrix and the Delphae busily muddying up the waters, the real truth probably won't ever come out into the open. He smiled faintly. I'm not sure how significant it is, but the Styrix tried to contaminate the historians, while the Delphae spent their time trying to contaminate the poets. Interesting contrast, wouldn't you say?
Afriel would know the truth.
Probably, but she's not talking. I know her well enough to know that her silence is deliberate. I don't think she really wants us to know who was originally at fault. She doesn't seem to want us to take sides for some reason, and that puts us in a very difficult position. I wonder if we'll ever find out the truth behind this racial antagonism. Not that it really matters. I doubt if Sophronia or the Anorai themselves even know. They've both had about 400 generations of hysterical propaganda to set their prejudices in stone. Our problem is that the Delphae can probably hold us here indefinitely. If we try to ride away, they'll just turn us around and lead us right back. So eventually we're going to have to negotiate with them. We all love Sophronia, though. So if we do negotiate with the Delphae, she'll take fire spontaneously.
Yes, I noticed that. What am I going to do, Sparhawk? I bleed when she so much as pricks her finger.
Lie to her. Sparhawk shrugged.
Sparhawk?
You don't have to be too obvious about it, but lean your neutrality slightly in her direction. I'm the one in charge of Velium, so Sedan's going to have to deal with me. Technically, you're secondary here. Sorry, Vanyan, but it's true. Sedan's going to be negotiating with me, not you. Glare at me now and then, and raise objections. Sophronia's behaving irrationally, so the others, like good, logical Alenes, are going to oppose her. Let's not isolate her entirely. You're the most important person in her life, and if you seem to be turning against her as well, you'll break her heart. He smiled a bit wryly. I'd take it as a personal favor, though, if you didn't let her turn me into a toad about midway through the negotiations. Let's go back a step or two, revered Anorai, Sparhawk suggested when they had gathered again in the large sunken room. I need to know what I'm getting involved in here. I'm not going to do anything to injure the Styrix. They're sometimes a prickly and difficult people, but we've grown fond of them for some reason. He smiled at Sophronia, hoping to soften her displeasure. You mentioned a journey of some sort. Where are you going?
We are changing, Annika. When the world turned against us, we appealed to Eidamus to protect us.
Your god? The Anorai nodded.
We were a childlike, unsophisticated people before the war with the Sirgai, and Eidamus lived among us, sharing our simple joys and transient sorrows. Of all the people of this world, we were the least suited for war.
The old man looked at Sophronia.
I will not offend thy teacher by speaking the truth about what led to our being made outcast.
The truth is well known, Sophronia said stiffly.
Yes, it is. But thy truth is quite different from ours. You believe that one thing happened, and we believe that something else took place. But that, Sophronia of Ilara, is between us, and it doth not concern these Alenes. In truth, lady, neither Styrix nor Delphae were very admirable in that unfortunate affair. For whatever cause, Annika, the Delphae were cast out, and the hands of all men were turned against us. We appealed, as I said, to Eidamus, and he responded by laying a curse on us.
This Eidamus of yours has a peculiar way of showing his affection, Ulaf noted.
It was the only way to protect us, Sir Knight. We are not warlike, and have no skill with the weapons with which other men kill each other. And so Eidamus cursed us to make our merest touch a weapon. Other men soon found that the touch of our hands meant death.
Then why am I still here, Sedan? Colton asked. I've been helping Zanisha on and off her horse for several days now, and her touch hasn't killed me.
We have learned to control the curse, Sir Colton. That was a part of the plan of Edamus when he raised his hand against our lake.
The lake?
The Enerai nodded.
Edamus could not bear the thought of laying his curse upon us directly, and so he cursed the waters of the lake instead. The lake is our only source of water, and we therefore must drink of it. When first we came to this valley, the mind of Edamus was as childlike as ours. In the spirit of play gave he the waters of the lake that peculiar essence which doth illuminate us. We drink of the lake, and its waters infuse our bodies. Out of love did Edamus make us appear like gods. It was a harmless entertainment, and we soon forgave him for so altering us. When the world turned against us, however, did Edamus curse the lake, and its infusing waters, changed by that curse, changed us as well. The touch of death which doth hold our enemies at bay is but a small part of the design of our God, however. Circumstance hath set us apart from this world, and it is the intent of Edamus to set us yet further apart. We are changing, my friends. Our bodies are different, and our minds and spirits as well. We are no longer as ye, nor as once we were. With each generation this inexorable change progresses. Zanisha, dear gentle Zanisha, so far surpasseth me that I cannot even begin to comprehend the extent of her thought. In time, methinks, she will equal, or even surpass, the very gods themselves.
And then you will supplant us, Sophronia accused, even as the trolls supplanted the Dawnmen, and as we are supplanting the trolls, so will you, despise Delphae, become our masters, putting aside our gods, and kenneling us like dogs in uninhabitable wastelands, while you enjoy the fruits of the earth. We Styrics have endured such treatment at the hands of the Alenes for eons, and we have learned much. You will not so easily subdue us, Sedan, and we will not worship you, nor fawn at your feet like whipped dogs.
How may we supplant thee and seize thy lands, Sophronia of Ilara? We are bound to our lake, and may not long be away from its waters. Thy submission, moreover, would have no meaning for us, for we will not be here. We journey toward the light, and we will become light. My Zanisha, who will be Anarae, could join with the light even now. But those of us who have not yet reached her perfection hold her back. When we are dead, there will no longer be any reason for her to remain, and she will lead the Delphae out to dwell among the stars with Edamus, who hath gone before us to prepare our home.
Where you will be gods, Sophronia added with a spiteful sneer.
That is a word without meaning, Sophronia of Ilara,
Zanisha said quietly.
All of us, gods and men, move toward the same goal. Edamus hath gone before us, and we will go before thee. We will await thy coming with love, and we will even forgive thee for the wrong that thou hast done us.
Forgive me? Sophronia exploded. I spurn thy condescending forgiveness. She had lapsed, probably without realizing it, into archaic Styric.
I will never forgive thee, nor accept any of thy forgiveness.
But thou wilt, Sophronia,
the glowing woman disagreed.
Even now is thine heart doubtful within thy breast. Thou art of two minds, gentle Sophronia. I know thee well, and I know that this hatred of thine, like winter frost, doth lurk in the dark shaded places of thy soul. I do assure thee that it will melt in the warm sun of thy loving nature, even as mine own hatred doth even now begin its painful thaw. But make no mistake, Sophronia of Ilara, I do hate Styrix, even as thou hatest the Delphae. An 100 centuries of enmity is not lightly cast aside. I do hate the perfidious Styrix, but I do not hate thee. I know thine heart, dear sister, for it is even as mine own. In time will we both put aside this childish hatred and live together in peace.
Never!
Never, dear sister, is a long, long time.
I think we're getting a little far afield here, Sparhawk cut in. This sealing up of the valley isn't intended to be eternal, I gather.
There would be no need of that, Annika, the Anarai replied. Once we are gone, Eudamus will lift his curse from the lake. Its waters will return to normal, and other men may freely come to this valley without fear.
I should probably tell you that if I seal the valley with Belium, I will seal it. I can guarantee you that no Delphae will ever leave. If you're going to turn into moonbeams or sunlight, that won't inconvenience you. But if you've got some other notion hidden away, you might as well forget it. And if this Eudamus of yours has a secret agenda involving some sort of retaliation against the Styrix, you'd better tell him to drop it. Belium eats gods for breakfast, as Azash found out. Do you still want me to seal your valley?
Yes,
Sedan replied without hesitation. How about you, Sophronia? Sparhawk asked. Would that kind of guarantee satisfy you?
They'll try trickery, Sparhawk. They're a deceitful race.
You know the Belium, Sophronia, probably even better than I do. Do you really think anybody, man or god, could trick it? If I tell it to keep the Delphae in and everybody else out, nobody's going to cross the line. Not you, not me, not Afriel, not Eudamus, not even the god of the Alenes. Even if all the gods of this world and of all other worlds combined, Belium would still keep them out. If I seal this valley, it will stay sealed. Even the birds and angleworms won't be able to leave. Will that satisfy you?
She refused to look at him.
I need an answer, little mother, and I'd rather not have to wait all year to get it. Will it satisfy you?
You're hateful, Sparhawk.
I've got a lot on my mind just now. Think it over and let me know what you decide.
He turned to face the Anarai.
All right. Now I know what you want. The next question is, what's in it for me? What do I get out of this arrangement?
Our assistance in thy struggle with thine enemies, Annika.
That's a little unspecific, Sedan. I've got the Belium. What can you possibly do for me that I can't do for myself?
Thou must have the cooperation of the jewel, Annika. Thou canst compel the stone, but it loves thee not, and it doth sometimes deliberately misunderstand thee, as when it took thee and the child goddess to Deimos, when thou sought to go to Delo in Arjuna.
How did you know about that?
Sparhawk was startled.
The mind is open to me, Annika, as are all minds. This is but one of the services we can offer thee.
Would it not be to thine advantage to know what those about thee are thinking?
It would indeed, Sedon, but there are other ways to wrest the truth from men's hearts.
But men who have been put to the torture know that they have been tortured, and they know what they have revealed unto thee. Our way is more subtle.
He's got a point there, Sparhawk, Carlton said. What am I thinking right now, Sedon?
Thou art troubled by the duty to slay Zanisha, should our people play thee false, Sir Knight. Thy mind is gently inclined toward her.
He's right about that, Carlton admitted to the others. I think these people can hear what others are thinking.
We have other capabilities as well, Sir Knight, the Enerai told them, and we freely offer them to thee in exchange for what we ask.
He looked rather sadly at Sophronia.
I fear that when I reveal the nature of these capabilities, it will cause thee pain and harden thine heart yet more toward us, dear sister.
Will you stop calling me that? My heart is already like granite toward you and your kind.
That is not true, Sophronia of Ilara,
Zanisha disagreed.
Thou art troubled, for as much as thou hast found no wickedness in us, in this thy first meeting with our kind. Hard put art thou to maintain an hatred which groweth more from thy sense of duty to thy kindred than from any personal rancor. I do freely confess mine own similarly troubled state. I am inclined to love thee, even as thou art so inclined toward me.
Stop that, Sophronia burst out. Keep your unclean hands out of my thoughts.
Stubborn, isn't she? Uloth murmured.
It is the nature of the younger gods of Styricum to protect their children, even from their own folly,
the Enerai noted.
Thus it is that the Styrix must appeal to their gods with spells and prayers for aid when they would step beyond the powers of other men. Is it not so, Sophronia of Ilara?
She refused to answer him.
That's the core of Styric magic, Sedon, Vanyan replied for her.
She glared at him, and Sparhawk silently groaned. Why couldn't Vanyan keep his mouth shut? The Enerai nodded.
Edamus hath, as I say, gone before us to prepare the way, and he is therefore no longer able to watch over us. Thus hath he granted certain of us the power to do what must be done without his guidance.
Unrestrained magic? Sophronia exclaimed. You hold the power of the gods in your own hands with no restraints?
Some few of us, yes.
That's monstrous. The human mind isn't capable of understanding the nature of that kind of power. We can't grasp the consequences of unleashing it to satisfy our childish whims.
Thy goddess hath instructed thee well, Sophronia of Ilara,
Zanisha noted.
This is what she wishes thee to believe.
Thy goddess would keep thee a child, dear sister, the Enerai said. For so long as thou art a child, she is secure in thy love. I tell thee truly, however, Edamus doth love us, even as thine Afriel doth love thee. His love, however, doth compel us to grow. He hath placed his power in our hands, and we must accept the consequences of our acts when we bring it to bear. It is a different kind of love, but it is love nonetheless. Edamus is no longer here to guide us, so we can do whatever our minds are able to conceive.
The Enerai smiled gently.
"Forgive me, my friends," he said to them, "but one as old as I hath but one peculiar interest." He held up one withered old hand and looked at it rather sadly. "How soon are we altered by the passing of years, and how distressing is the alteration!" The change seemed gradual, but considering the staggering nature of that change, what was happening before their eyes was nearly miraculous. The withered hand grew more firm-fleshed, the knobby joints smoothed, and the wrinkles faded. It was not only the hand, however. The tracery of wrinkles and lines on Seddon's face seemed to slide away. His hollow cheeks filled out, and his thin, wispy hair grew fuller, more abundant. They stared at him, as, with no apparent effort, he reversed the erosion of years. He regressed to vigorous youth, his skin clear and his hand and face firm and unmarked. Then he began to diminish, his limbs shrinking inside his garments. The prickly stubble vanished from his cheeks and chin, and, as he continued to regress, his head seemed to grow larger in proportion to his shrinking body.
"That might be far enough," he said in a piping, childish voice.
He smiled, a strangely ancient smile that looked very much out of place on that little boy's face.
"A miscalculation here might reduce me to nothing. In truth, I have considered that, but my tasks and responsibilities are not yet completed. Zanisha has her own tasks, and I would not yet burden her with mine as well."
Sparhawk swallowed hard.
"I think you've made your point, Seddon," he said in a strained voice. "We'll accept the fact that you can do things that we can't do."
He looked around at his friends.
"I can already see arguments brewing," he told them, deliberately avoiding Sophrenia's eyes. "And no matter what we decide, we'll probably all have serious doubts about it."
"We could pray," Bevier suggested.
"Or roll dice and let them decide," Ulof added. "Not with your dice we couldn't," Kalton objected.
"We could even fall back on logic," Vanyan concluded. "But Sparhawk's right. No matter how we try to decide, we could probably sit here all winter and still not agree."
He also avoided Sophrenia's eyes. "All right, then," Sparhawk said, reaching inside his tunic. "Since Afriel's not here to bully us into agreement, we'll let Belium decide." He took out the golden box and set it on the table in front of him.
"Sparhawk!" Sophrenia gasped.
"No, Annika!"
Zanisha also exclaimed.
"Belium doesn't love any of us," he said, "so we can sort of rely on its neutrality. We need guidance here, and neither Edamus nor Afriel is around to provide it. Besides which, I don't know that I'd trust either of them anyway, given the peculiar circumstances here. We want an uncontaminated opinion. So why don't we just find out what Belium thinks about the situation?"
Chapter 15 "Blue Rose," Sparhawk said in Trollish to the glowing jewel in his hands,
"I am Annika. Do you know me?"
Belium's glow pulsed slightly, and Sparhawk could sense the stone's stiff reluctance to acknowledge his dominion. Then he thought of something.
"You and I need to talk," he said, speaking in Alenic this time. "And I don't think Quadge and the others need to be listening. Can you understand me when I speak in this fashion?"
There was the faintest hint of curiosity in the pulse this time.
"Good. Is there some way you can talk to me? There's something you and I have to decide. This is too important for me to simply force you to do what I want, because I could be wrong. I know you're none too fond of me, or of any creature on this particular world, but I think that we may have some common interest this time."
"Let me go."
The voice was a kind of lingering whisper, but it was familiar. Sparhawk whirled around to stare at Kalton. His boyhood friend's face was wooden, uncomprehending, and the words came stiffly from his lips.
"Why hast thou done this thing, Annika? Why hast thou enslaved me?
The archaic Alenic could not have come from Kaltan. But why had Belium chosen this most unlikely mouth? Sparhawk carefully readjusted his thoughts, casting them in the profoundly formal language with which the stone had addressed him. And in the instant of that changeover, perception and understanding came. It somehow seemed that knowledge had lain dormant in his mind until unlocked by this peculiar key. Strangely, his understanding had been bound up in language, and once he made the conscious shift from contemporary Alenic, with all its casual imprecision, to more stately and concise cadences, that previously closed part of his mind opened.
It was not I who enslaved thee, Blue Rose. It was thine own inattention that brought thee into such perilous proximity to the red of iron, which congealed thee into thy present state. And it was Gwerig who lifted thee from the earth and contorted thee into this similitude of a flower with his cruel diamond implements.
A stifled groan came from Kaltan's lips, a groan of pain endured and pain remembered.
I am Annika, Blue Rose, Sparhawk continued. I am thy creature. It is thou who hast caused me to be, that I might be the instrument of thy liberation, and I will not betray thy trust in me. I am in some part made of thy thought, and I am therefore thy servant. It is thou who hast enslaved me. Didst thou not set my destiny apart, making me a stranger to the gods of this world and to all other men? But though I am thine enslaved servant, I am nonetheless still of this world, and I will not have it destroyed, nor its people crushed by the vile oppression of mine enemies. I did free thee from the enslavement of Gwerig, did I not? Is this not in some small measure proof of my fidelity to the task which thou hast laid upon me? And, bound together in common purpose, did we not destroy Azash, who would have chained us both in a slavery harsher than that which now chains us together? For mistake me not, Blue Rose, even as thou art my slave, so am I thine. And once again the chain which binds us together is common purpose, and neither shall be free until that purpose be accomplished. Then shalt thou, and then shall I, be free to go our separate ways, I to remain, and thou to go, and it please thee, to continue thine interrupted and endless journey to the farthest star.
Thou hast learned well, Annika, Belium said grudgingly, but thine understanding of thy situation did never obtrude itself upon thy conscious thought where I could perceive it. I had despaired, thinking that I had wrought amiss.
Sophrenia was staring at them, first at Sparhawk, and then at the seemingly comatose Kaltan, and her pale, flawless face was filled with something very like chagrin. Zanisha stared also, and her expression was no less chagrined. Sparhawk took a fleeting satisfaction in that. The two were very much alike in their perhaps unconscious assumption of condescending superiority. Sparhawk's sudden, unexpected awareness of things long concealed in his understanding had shaken that irritating smugness of theirs. For the first time in his life, he consciously knew that he was Annika, and more importantly, he knew the meaning of Annika in ways neither Sophrenia nor Zanisha could ever begin to comprehend. He had stepped around them to reach Belium, and in joining his thought with Belium's, he had to some degree shared Belium's awareness. And that was something neither of them could ever do.
Thou hast not wrought amiss, Blue Rose, he told the jewel. Thine error lay in casting thy thought in this particular speech. Mine understanding was also cast so, and it did not reveal itself to me until I responded to thy words in kind. Now let us to work withal. Mine enemies are also thine, for as much as they would bind thee, even as they would bind me. Neither of us shall be secure in our freedom until they are no more. Are we agreed upon that?
Thy reasoning is sound, Annika.
Our purpose, then, is the same?
So it would seem.
We are making some headway here, Sparhawk murmured. Colton's expression became coldly disapproving. Sorry, Sparhawk apologized. Force of habit, I suppose. Reason doth urge that since our enemies and our purpose are common, and our thoughts are linked by this chain of thy forging, we must join our efforts in this cause. In victory shall we be freed. Our enemies and our common purpose shall be no more, and the chain which links us will fall away. I do pledge it to thee that upon the completion of this task will I free thee to continue thy work. My life is surely within thy fist, and thou mayest destroy me if I play thee false.
I find no falsity in thy thought, Annika, and I will strengthen thine arm and harden thine heart, lest others, beloved by thee, seek to turn thee aside from thy design and thy pledge. We are agreed.
Done, then, Sparhawk exclaimed.
And done!
Belium's speech, emerging from Carlton's lips, had been dry and unemotional. But this time the voice was exultant. And now to this decision which thou and I must make together.
Sparhawk,
Sophrenia's tone was uncertain. I'm sorry, little mother, he said. I'm not talking with you at the moment. Please don't interrupt.
Sparhawk was not entirely sure whether he should address his question to the Sapphire Rose or to Carlton, who seemed to have been completely taken over by the spirit within the jewel. He settled for directing his question somewhere between them.
The Delphi have offered their assistance in exchange for a certain service, he said. They would have us seal their valley, that none may enter and none may leave, and in recompense for that small favor, they promise to aid us. Is their offer made in good faith?
Sparhawk heard Zanisha's sharp intake of breath.
It is, Belium replied. There is no falsity in their offer.
I didn't think so myself, but I wanted to be sure.
Annika!
The voice was firm.
When thou speakest so, thy mind is concealed from me. Our alliance is new and unfamiliar. It is not wise of thee to raise doubts in me by compressing thy words together so.
Sparhawk suddenly laughed. Forgive my lapse, Blue Rose, he said. We can trust the Delphi, then?
For the moment, yes. Their intent is presently without guile. It is uncertain what it will be tomorrow. Thy kind is inconstant, Annika.
Colton's voice hesitated briefly.
I say that not as criticism, merely as observation. For the nonce mayest thou put thy trust in their sincerity, and they in thine. What may come subsequently lieth in the hands of chance.
Then there is such a thing as chance?
Sparhawk was a bit surprised at that.
We are told that all things are predetermined by the gods.
Whosoever told thee so was in error.
Bevier gasped.
My journey and my task were interrupted by chance,
Belium continued.
If my course may be turned aside, might not thine as well? Truly I tell thee, Annika, we must join with the Delphi in this enterprise, for if we do not, we shall surely fail. Whether one or both play the other false will depend on circumstance. At this time, the hearts of the Delphi are pure. That may change. At this time, thine heart is also pure. That may also change. But will we, nil we must join with them, lest we fail and languish forever in vilest bondage.
You heard him, Bevier, Sophrenia was saying to the olive-skinned Archean later, when Sparhawk quietly entered the room where the two were deep in conversation. They worship the lake, the source of the contamination that makes them outcast. He did mention a god, Lady Sophrenia, Bevier protested mildly. I think he called their god Edamus, or something like that. But Edamus has abandoned them, cursed them, and then turned his back on them. Anarai said that Edamus had gone before them to prepare a place for them.
Bevier's objection seemed even weaker.
He said that they were changing, turning into pure light.
Lies, she snapped.
The light that marks them is not the mark of a blessing, Bevier. It's the mark of their curse. Sedan was cleverly trying to twist it around, to make it seem that the Delphi are turning into something holy, when the reverse is actually true.
They do perform magic, Sophrenia, and a kind of magic I've never seen before.
I wouldn't have believed that anyone could return to childhood if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes.
Exactly my point, Bevier. They're using witchcraft, not magic. You've never seen me imitate a god, have you?
Sparhawk stepped unobserved back out into the hallway and went on down to the doorless cell Vanyan occupied.
We've got a problem, he told the preceptor of the Pandians.
Another one?
Sophrenia is trying to subvert Bevier. She's trying to convince him that the Delphi practice witchcraft. You know Bevier. His eyes start to bulge out any time anyone so much as mentions the word.
Why won't she just leave it alone?
Vanyan exclaimed, throwing his hands in the air.
Wasn't Bellium's word good enough for her?
She doesn't want to believe, Vanyan, Sparhawk sighed. We've run into exactly the same thing when we've tried to convince rural Alenes that Styrix aren't born with horns and tails.
She, of all people, should be free of that sort of thing.
I'm afraid not, my friend. Styrix are good haters, I guess. How do we want to handle this?
I'll confront her directly.
Sparhawk winced.
She'll turn you into a frog if you do.
Vanyan smiled briefly.
No. I lived in Sarsos, remember? Asteric can't do anything like that without the consent of his god. And Afriel's sort of fond of me, I hope.
I'll round up the others and get them out from underfoot, so that you can speak with her privately.
No, Sparhawk. It has to be done in front of them. She's trying to slip around behind us to recruit converts. They're all going to have to be made aware of the fact that she's not to be trusted in this particular situation.
Wouldn't it be a little better to talk with her privately at first, before you humiliate her publicly?
Vanyan shook his head stubbornly.
We've got to meet this head on, he declared.
You'd better hope that Afriel's fond of you. Sparhawk murmured.
They've reverted to total paganism, Sophrenia said stubbornly. They might as well worship trees or oddly shaped rocks. They have no creed, no doctrine, and no restraints. Their use of witchcraft proves that.
They had gathered at Vanyan's summons in a large room at the end of the hall, and Sophrenia was urgently, even stridently, trying to make her case.
What's the difference?
Talon shrugged.
Magic, witchcraft, it's all the same, isn't it?
Magic is of the gods, Talon, Bevier explained. Our Holy Mother, in her wisdom, has chosen to allow the Church Knights to learn the secrets of Styricum, that we might better serve her. There are restraints on us, certain areas we may not enter. Witchcraft is unrestrained, because it is of the evil one.
The devil, you mean? I've never really believed in the devil. There's plenty of concentrated wickedness in people anyway, so we can probably get along fairly well without him. I've known some very nasty people, Bevier.
The existence of the devil has been proved.
Not to me, it hasn't.
Aren't we wandering a bit?
Ulof suggested.
Does it really matter what the Delphi worship? We've allied ourselves with all sorts of people in the past in order to achieve this or that goal. Bellium says that we have to join forces with the Delphi, or we're going to lose. I don't like losing. So what's the problem?
Bellium doesn't know anything about this world, Ulof, Sophrenia said.
So much the better. It comes at the problem with a clear and uncluttered understanding. If I need to jump behind a tree to keep from being swept away by an avalanche, I'm not going to stop to question the tree about its beliefs first.
Bellium will do or say anything in order to gain its freedom, Sophrenia asserted. That's why I was so much against using it in the first place.
We have to believe Bellium, Sophrenia,
Vanyan told her, obviously trying to keep his irritation under control.
It doesn't make much sense for us to trust it with our very lives and then not believe what it tells us, does it? It has done some very useful things for us in the past, you know.
Only because it was compelled to, Vanyan. Belium submits because it's forced to submit. I trust the Belium even less than I trust the Delphi. It's alien, totally alien, and we have no way of knowing what it will do. We are safe only for as long as we keep it chained and force it to obey us. The minute we begin to listen to it, we are in great danger.
Is that how you feel about us too, little mother? He asked her sadly. We are Alleans, and as a race we've proved time and again that we're not to be trusted. Do you want to chain us as well, and force us to obey you?
Don't be absurd. Belium's not a person.
The Delphae are, though, aren't they?
No.
You're being illogical, Sophrenia. The Delphae are human. We don't care for the Zemox or the Rendors, but we've never tried to pretend that they aren't human. There are a lot of Alleans who don't like you Styrix, but we've never gone so far as to try to deny your humanity.
He paused, then drew in a deep breath.
I guess that's what it comes down to, love. If you're going to deny the humanity of the Delphae, how can I be positive that you don't secretly feel the same way about me? I've lived in Sarsos, and many of the Styrix there wanted to treat me like some lower life form. Did you agree with them? Have I been some kind of pet, Sophrenia? A dog, maybe? Or a tame ape that you kept around for your private amusements? Hang it all, Sophrenia. This is a question of morality. If we deny anyone's humanity, we open the door to unimaginable horror. Can't you see that?
The Delphi are different.
Nobody's different. We have to believe that, because if we don't, we deny our own humanity as well. Why won't you understand?
Her face was very, very pale. This is all very high-sounding and noble, Vanyan, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with the Delphae. You don't know anything about what they are or who they are, so you don't really know what you're talking about. You've always come to me for guidance in the past when your ignorance was putting you in danger. Am I correct in assuming that we're not going to do that anymore?
Don't be silly.
I'm not. I'm being very serious. Are you going to ignore me on this issue? Are you going to take up with these monstrous lepers, no matter what I tell you?
We don't have any choice in the matter. Can't you see that? Belium tells us that we're going to fail if we don't. And we can't fail. I think the whole world's going to depend on our not failing.
You seem to have outgrown your need for me, then. It would have been polite of you to have told me that before you brought me to this accursed valley, but I suppose I was silly to expect politeness from an Alleen in the first place. As soon as we get back to Mytherian, I'll make arrangements to return to Sarsos, where I belong.
Sophrenia?
No. This concludes it. I've served the Pandian Order well, and faithfully, for 300 years, and I thank you for your generous payment for my years of toil. We're through, Vanyan. This ends it. I hope the rest of your life will be happy. But happy or sad, you're going to live it without me. And she turned and swept from the room.
It will be very dangerous, Anarai, Itanya warned. And Zanisha is the most important of all your people. Is it prudent to risk her life?
Truly, Itanya of Mytherian, the old man replied. Zanisha is precious to us, for she will be Anarai. She is, however, the most gifted of us, and it may well be that her gifts will weight the scale in our final confrontation with our common enemy.
Sparhawk, Vanyan, and Itanya had been summoned to meet with Sedan prior to their departure from the Valley of Delphaeus. It was a fine autumn morning, a hint of frost, fast melting in the newly risen sun, steamed on the meadow. And the shade under the boughs of the evergreens beyond that meadow was a deep, deep blue.
I merely wish to point it out, Anarai, Itanya said. For all its splendor, Mytherian is a city filled with hidden dangers, with rough, ignorant people who will react very strongly to the appearance of one of the Delphae in their midst. Your gentle Zanisha is an ethereal, unworldly sort of person, hardly more than a girl.
The fact that she's a Shining One will protect her to some degree against overt physical attack. But are you really willing to expose her to the curses, the vituperation, and all the other kinds of abuse she's sure to encounter there at the center of the world? The Emirai smiled.
Thou hast misperceived Zanisha, Itanya of Mithurien. Doth she truly seem so much a child to thee? Would thy mind be more easy if thou wert aware that she is well past her first century of life?
Itanya stared at him, and then at Zanisha, who sat quietly near the window. You are a strange people, Anarai, he said. I'd have guessed her age at no more than 16 years.
It is impolite to speculate about a lady's age, Itanya of Mithurien.
The pale woman smiled. Forgive me, Anarai, Itanya replied with a courtly bow.
His Excellency here has raised a fairly important point, Anarai, Vanyan said.
The preceptor's face was still marked by the pain of the previous day's conversation with Sophronia.
The lady's appearance won't go unnoticed, not only in Mithurien itself, but along the roads we'll have to follow as we ride east as well. Is there some way we could disguise her enough so that whole villages won't go into absolute panic the moment she rides by?
He looked apologetically at the Delphaic woman.
I wouldn't offend you for the world, Anarai, but you are very striking.
I thank thee for the compliment, gentle sir.
Do you want to take over, Sparhawk? Vanyan said. I just seem to be digging myself in deeper.
We're soldiers, Zanisha, Sparhawk said bluntly, and our answer to hostility is fairly direct. We can butcher our way from here to the Imperial Palace in Mithurien if we have to, but I get the feeling that you might find that distressing. Would a disguise of some kind offend you?
Then a thought came to him.
Can we disguise you? I don't know if you've noticed, but you glow. Some of your people have come fairly close to us before the light started to show. Can your internal fire be dampened?
We can control the light, Annika, Sedan assured him. And Zanisha, the most gifted of us all, can control it even better than most, though it doth cause her pain to do so. For us it is an unnatural thing.
We'll have to work on that, then.
The pain is of no moment, Annika, Zanisha assured him.
Not to you, perhaps, but it is to me. Let's start with your coloration, though. Your features are Tamil, but your skin and hair are the wrong color. What do you think, Itanya? Could she pass for Tamil if we dyed her skin and hair?
That is not needful, Annika,
Zanisha told him. Her brow furrowed briefly in concentration, and gradually, almost like a slow blush, a faint golden tint began to mount in her cheeks, and her hair slipped from its colorless white into pale blonde.
Color is a quality of light,
she explained quite calmly, even as the embronzing of her skin and the darkening of her hair continued.
And since I can control the light from within me, so can I also control my color. Indeed, by thus altering the light, rather than suppressing it entirely, I can lessen the pain. A most happy solution for me, and for thee as well, I wot, since thou seemest sensitive to the pain of others. This is a simple matter.
Her skin by now was almost the same pale gold as Itanya's, and her hair was a deep, rich auburn.
The change of shape is far more difficult,
she conceded,
and the change of gender more difficult still.
The what? Itanya choked.
I do not do that often, nor willingly, she replied. Edamus did not intend for me to be a man, and I find it most uncomfortable. A man's body is so cluttered and untidy.
She held out her arm and examined it closely.
The color seemeth to me correct,
she observed. Then she took a lock of her now black hair and looked at it.
And this as well,
she added.
What thinkest thou, Itanya? Would I pass unnoticed in Mithurian now?
Hardly, divine Zanisha, he smiled. Thy passage through the streets of fire-domed Mithurian would stop the hearts of all who beheld thee, for thou art fair, and thy beauty doth bedazzle mine eye beyond all measure.
Well said, Sparhawk murmured.
Thine honeyed words fall sweetly upon mine ears, Itania,
Zanisha smiled.
Thou art, I do believe, a master of flattery.
You should probably know that Itania is a diplomat, Anore,
Vanyan advised her,
and his words aren't always to be trusted. This time he's telling you the truth, though. You're an extraordinarily beautiful woman.
She looked at him gravely.
Thine heart is sore within thee, is it not, Lord Vanyan?
She observed. He sighed.
It's my personal problem, Anore, he replied.
Not entirely so, my lord. Now are we all of the same fellowship, and the troubles of one are the troubles of all. But that which troubleth thee is of far greater note, and causeth us all much greater concern than that which might grow from our comradely feelings for thee. This breach between thy beloved and thee doth endanger our cause, and until it be healed, our common purpose doth stand in peril.
They rode eastward, following a scarcely perceptible track that seemed more like a game trail than a route normally followed by humans. Sophronia, accompanied by Bevier and young Barrett, rode some distance to the rear, her face set and her eyes as hard as flint. Sparhawk and Vanyan rode in the lead, following occasional directions from Zanisha, who rode directly behind them under Calton's watchful eye.
"Just give her some time, Vanyan," Sparhawk was saying. "Women deliver ultimatums and declarations of war fairly often. Things like that are usually intended to get our attention. Any time I start neglecting Aelana, she says something she doesn't really mean to bring me up short."
"I'm afraid this goes a little further than that, Sparhawk," Vanyan replied. "Sophronia's hysteric, but she's never been so totally irrational before. If we could find out what's behind this insane hatred of hers, we might be able to do something about it. But we've never been able to get any coherent reasons out of her. Apparently, she hates the Delphae simply because she hates the Delphae."
"Afriel will straighten it out," Sparhawk said confidently. "As soon as we get back to Mithurian, I'll have a talk with Danae and—"
Sparhawk broke off as a sudden thought chilled his blood.
"I have to talk with Zanisha," he said, abruptly wheeling Farron around.
"Trouble?" Calton asked as Sparhawk joined them.
"Nothing immediate," Sparhawk replied. "Why don't you go on ahead and ride with Vanyan for a while? I need to talk with Zanisha."
Calton gave him a questioning look, but rode on forward without any further questions.
"Thou art troubled, Annika,"
Zanisha observed.
"A little, yes. You know what I'm thinking, don't you?"
She nodded.
"Then you know who my daughter is?"
"Yes."
"It's a sort of secret, Anore. Afriel didn't consult with my wife when she chose her present incarnation. It's very important that Aelana doesn't find out. I think her sanity depends on it."
"Thy secret is safe, Annika. I do pledge thee my silence on this issue."
"What really happened, Zanisha, between the Styrix and the Delphae, I mean? I don't want your version or Sophronia's. I want the truth."
"Thou art not meant to know the truth, Annika. A part of thy task is to resolve this issue without recourse to the truth."
"I'm an Aline, Zanisha," he said in a pained voice. "I have to have facts in order to make decisions."
"Then it is thine intent to judge? To decide if the guilt doth condemn the Styrix or the Delphae?"
"No. My intent is to get to the bottom of Sophronia's behavior, so that I can change her mind."
"Is she so important to thee?"
"Why do you ask questions when you already know the answers?
My questions are intended to help thee formulate thy thoughts, Annika.
I'm a Pandian knight, Zanisha. Sifrini has been the mother of our order for 3 centuries. Any one of us would give up his life for her without any hesitation at all. We love her, but we don't share all of her prejudices. He leaned back in his saddle. I'll only wait for so long, Zanisha. If I don't get the real truth out of you, or out of Sophronia, I'll just ask Belium.
Thou wouldst not!
Her now dark eyes were filled with a sudden chagrin. I'm a soldier, Zanisha, so I don't have the patience for subtlety. You'll excuse me? I have to go talk with Sophronia for a moment.
Dirges,
Zanisha told them as they crested a hill and saw a typical Aton town lying in the valley below.
Well, finally, Vanyan said, taking out his map. Now we know where we are.
He looked over his map for a moment, and then squinted up at the evening sky.
Is it too late in the day for us to take one of those long steps, Sparhawk?
No, my lord, Sparhawk replied. There's plenty of light.
Are we still concerned about that?
Ulof asked.
Haven't you and Belium hammered that out yet?
We haven't been having any private chats, Sparhawk replied. There are still people out there who can locate Belium when it's out in the open, so I've been keeping it inside its little house, just to be on the safe side.
It's well over 300 leagues, Sparhawk, Vanyan pointed out. It's going to be later there.
I'm never going to get used to that, Calton said sourly. It's really very simple, Calton, Ulof told him. You see, when the sun goes down in Mithurin, it's still...
Please, Ulof, Calton told him. Don't try to explain it to me. It just makes things worse. When people start to explain it, I sometimes think I can actually feel the world moving under me. I don't like that very much. Just tell me that it's later there, and let it go at that. I don't really need to know why it's later.
He's a perfect knight, Khalad told his brother. He doesn't even want explanations.
Look on the bright side of it, Khalad, Talon replied. After we've gone through the wonderful training they've got planned for us, we'll be exactly like Calton. Think how much easier life's going to be for us when we don't have to understand anything at all.
I guess that it's very close to being fully dark in Mithurin by now, Sparhawk, Vanyan said. Maybe we'd better wait until morning.
I'm not so sure, Sparhawk disagreed. The time's going to come sooner or later when we're going to have to make one of these jumps after the sun goes down. There's nothing urgent in the wind right now, so it's a good time for us to answer this question once and for all.
Ah, Sparhawk,
Khalad said.
Yes?
If you've got a question, why not ask? Now that you and Belium are on speaking terms, wouldn't it be simpler and safer to just ask it first, before you start experimenting? Mithurin's on the coast, as I recall, and I'd rather not come down about 100 leagues out to sea.
Sparhawk felt just a little foolish. He took out the small golden box and opened the lid. He paused momentarily, casting his question in antique Alenic.
I must needs have thine advice on a certain matter, Blue Rose, he said.
Say thy question, Annika.
This time the voice came from Khalad's lips.
That's a relief, Calton said to Ulof. I almost chewed up my tongue with all the thees and thous last time. Can we go safely from one place to another when the pall of darkness hath covered the earth? Sparhawk asked.
There is no darkness for me, Annika.
I did not know that.
Thou hadst but to ask.
Yes, I do perceive that now. Mine understanding doth grow with each passing hour.
End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.